My Family Thinks I'm Crazy, a podcast where I, your host, try to give you some tips on how you can explain all this weird, wild, crazy conspiracy stuff to the people you love most. Because that's what I've been trying to do for the past 10 years with no success. I've been telling everybody that our government is shady, but every time I do, my family thinks I'm crazy. The hollow earth, UFOs, aliens invading, fluoride in the water, they spray our skies daily. When I talk about these things, they think I'm crazy. There's no escaping anymore the evil that we're facing. Illuminati mind control, they're sacrificing babies. The end of days, but anyways, my family thinks I'm crazy.
What, they don't want to listen to you?
No, they don't want to listen. They don't want to hear it. They're just like, oh, here we go, Mark. Off again with your
Mark being Mark again.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, that's the thing about podcasts is when you're on the air, and it's like therapy, you know. If I can't talk to my family about this stuff, I'll talk to you, Matt, and all our listeners.
You know, just tell your whole podcast.
Yeah. So who are we talking about today, Matt?
A dozen different historians and academic scholars, they basically say all say the same thing, and you can test this if you just like keyword search it. Between 1450-ish, maybe 1500 and 1700, between there, so the 1500s, 1600s, early 1700s, to be called Portuguese in the Americas was synonymous with being Jewish. It was a kind of a don't ask, don't tell kind of nickname for Jews in the New World, because Jews were outright outlawed in the New World. So to even whisper or to gossip about someone being Jewish would actually, yes, you could get, you know, yes, you could kind of accuse anyone of being Jewish, but it's kind of like going to court. You know, if you drag someone to court, you have to go to court too. So everyone was afraid of the Inquisition. People were afraid of making false allegations, and people were afraid of getting dragged in and being squeezed for, you know, more accusations, because that would happen too, you know. And so basically, no one would even, people would rarely even utter the word Jew in the New World. And if they did want to do that, or just kind of speak casually about someone who may or may not be Jewish, they would call them Portugals or Portuguese.
You just heard today's guest, who joins me, Mystic Mark, here on the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. Thank you for tuning in, and enjoy this conversation with Dr. Narco Longo. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. Returning to the show is the man behind Old World Florida, that is Dr. Narco Longo himself. Good friend of the show, good friend of our friend Juan over there at the One on One podcast. Happy to see Juan come out of his retirement, partly thanks to you, I think, Dr. Narco. So thank you for that. And, you know, here we are back again. Thanks again for joining Kurt as well. For people who haven't seen The Derp with Kurt, Dr. Narco was the most recent guest. So aside from all that, how have you been?
I've been great, dude, and thanks again for having me on. Yeah, and you know, it's good to have Juan back. So me and Juan are back in full swing on a pretty good schedule, and you're doing a show with him too, right? You know, every so often.
Yeah, I'm just, you know, lazy when it comes to booking the guests lately, and I know Juan has Tuesdays available, so I'm like, oh, look, his ears were ringing.
Look at that. No way.
Yeah, and I know he's a bit when he's available, so I just like to throw him in the ring when I can, because he's got a lot to say, doesn't always give himself credit. But Juan's great. So let me ask you, you're in the bookstore, you put out a tremendous amount of content on your YouTube channel. How often are your deep dives, if you will, inspired by things you come across in the bookstore? Like, is there a level of synchronicity or serendipity to being in the bookstore when it comes to that kind of thing?
Totally. Yeah, 100%. You know, I can't downplay the, you know, the kind of materials I have at my disposal here. And I never want to come off as like, you know, I've got these books and no one else does. So, but, and also, you know, a lot of times on my channel, it's kind of like a breath of fresh air from being around here, going around Florida and exploring more, boots on the ground. It's sometimes like a whole different universe, but yes, in many cases, especially like the Jewish Pirates book, that's a book that we sell here at the bookstore. It's one of our top sellers, one of our like all time top sellers. We sell out almost every week, you know, 5 copies a week or so, if not more. And
sounds like it's advantageous to, you know, talk about certain books, especially considering you got a good group of local supporters and followers who are patronizing the shop. Yeah. Awesome, man.
Yeah. And, you know, there's also a lot of good books that just kind of support, in more of a general sense, support, you know, some of the theories I get into. Like, we have some books about Jesus, theories about Jesus's appearances in the Americas, some of which are non-Mormon, right? So sometimes I talk about that theory about either the Bible being connected to the Americas in any way, or vice versa, or Jesus, you know, basically Native Americans having legends of something similar to Jesus. Very, very many parallels. And so when many people hear that today, they think, oh, that's just a Mormon thing, right? Well, not necessarily. One of my favorite rabbit holes is the whole, you know, starting with Columbus, how much Bible, biblical stuff, or what seemed to be biblical traditions, you know, cultures, little even artifacts, you know, eventually were already here in America before Columbus. So we have a great book here in the bookstore. It's probably one of our most expensive books. It's called He Walked the Americas. And I think that author, from what I've heard, he ended up being Mormon because, you know, they closely aligned with his theories. I don't know the whole story, but he basically cataloged all the similar legends to America, or similar legends in America, of Jesus, who they call the peacemaker, the son of the breath maker, or the breath maker himself, you know, variations. And then also stories of words like Yo-Hey-Wah, Jehovah, words like that in the Native American, you know, pantheon. And so, you know, I've been into stuff like that. And right here behind me is like the Native American section. And I had a friend who was in here, and he was just going through the books, and he found 2 copies of that book. He Walked the Americas, and we had them priced for $30. Turns out they're worth closer to $1,000, you know, $500, $1,000, maybe even more. Really, really nice books. And so I just stumbled onto those, you know. Didn't even realize they were in here, and stuff like that happens all the time.
See, now, you know, Dr. Narco, with my new occupation, we might have a good little deal here. I actually stumbled upon one of those books as well, because I've been doing like clear outs and like helping people get rid of their junk, to, you know, mainly to find valuable things to resell. And being a book hound, a book obsessor for so many years, I, you know, especially esoteric books, I knew immediately like that He Who Walked the Americas book was something. My friend Michael Wan actually showed me a copy of that book once, So I'd before, and he didn't want to give it to me. Mike gave me a bunch of books, and that was one that I was like, can I have this one? He's like, no. So when I saw it, I was like, oh, I got to get this, right? And as you probably know, you can find all sorts of treasures at used bookstores well under their actual price. And you know, if you can find the right buyer, yeah, I imagine that that book is that valuable. So who knows? Maybe one day I'll give you a call and say, hey, what's the address? I'm sending you a box.
Well, you know, interestingly about the two copies of He Walked the Americas, they're old. They're first edition, I believe, but they're unused. They're unowned. So they are brand new. They've just been on the shelves for, you know, decades. And also, you know, we just took, there was a guy who worked in Washington, D.C., some archivist who passed away in the area recently. And, you know, we get to go through, you know, kind of like estate sales and stuff like that and dig into cool old books. But we are mostly like maybe 90% new books. So some of them are old and vintage, but many of them are still unowned. You know, they just have been here a long time.
Well, and that's the thing, you know, we are sort of piggybacking off of some of the things I heard you say while I was producing your conversation with Kurt the other day. And, you know, there is a tremendous amount of old books that are truly worthless, right? Like, and it is trouble to sort through them because not only are they outdated and have wrong information in them, but they're also like equated language that's not always easy to read, right? So it's, I get your point there, but with the exception of those few gems. So it almost makes like for a guy like me, worth it to sort through the junk to find that needle in the haystack. That's not the most profitable end of book selling. So I get where you're at with that. But just as a collector of strange ideas, I mean, that book kind of stands in a special category, right? So maybe let's get into some of the veracity to this. Because I like you, have a huge amount of respect for anybody who puts a book out that, you know, like is controversial. And that topic wasn't always so controversial. Now it's very controversial, but there was a certain time in American history where they readily accepted this idea that maybe events from the Bible took place in this new, what they were calling a new world.
100%. And, you know, I probably sound like a broken record a lot of the time, always talking about Columbus, but it's hard not to because so much of what we, you know, pretty much everything, you know, our whole window into American history kind of begins with him. And he, Christopher Columbus himself, was theorizing about biblical events in the Americas. He suspected that the lands he discovered, which, you know, he kind of pretended he was just looking for Asia. Because remember, he had to get the approval of the king and the queen. The king and the queen of Spain, who are in the process of expelling the Jews, many of Columbus's, you know, best friends and financiers, they weren't necessarily going to sign on for a voyage to an unknown, mysterious Atlantis-like continent that we may or may not even know exists, that may or may not be referenced in the Bible, just for this kind of Hail Mary escape mission, right? So I believe that's kind of what Columbus was going for. But what he had to show the king and the queen, what he was pitching to them was very different. That's where you get looking for Asia, looking for China, looking for India, looking for a new route to the spice trade, stuff like that. Well, I think we can show pretty clearly Columbus's motivations were much different than that. They may have included those a little bit, but like I mentioned, you know, in Kurt's show, Columbus did some traveling. He sampled around. He fished around for legends and reliable, you know, navigational facts and you know, old archives, right, that no one was interested in. So Columbus went to Ireland. He went to Iceland. In Ireland, he heard about St. Brendan. He heard about Prince Madoc, these guys who, legend tells, they crossed the Atlantic to this other world, right? Avalon. The Welsh called it Appalach. Real interesting word there, Appalach. Keep that one in mind. And then he went to Iceland, and of course he heard about Leif Erikson. So he knew something was over here. He knew the climate was a little different in what they had found from Asia that he was kind of pretending to look for. But, you know, he was hopeful. He was open-minded. But also, he believed, he in his writings, he talked about Ophir, Tarshish. He talked about, what's the other one? I always get the name wrong. It's either Azareth or Arizeth. It's another one of like these faraway lands across a body of water that you know, people were expelled to or ran away to. And Columbus believed in these places. Another thing, after the fact, skipping forward a little bit, Columbus's own son, who wrote the biography of, you know, the official, most concise, intimate biography of Columbus, his father, the admiral, in his biography, he wrote that Columbus, when he got to the Caribbean, he believed he had found the Fortunate Isles, the Hesperidian Islands, or the Atlantides, basically, which were an island, a group of islands that have kind of been attached to Atlantis in different legends. They're certainly connected in legends, but geographically, it's always kind of different how close they were together. But the Hesperides were these islands out in the west that were kind of on the way to Atlantis. So they knew about the Canaries a little bit. They had some legends about the Canaries. But then even farther beyond that, there were all these other legends. So, for example, they call the Caribbean, after the Caribs, right? The Carib tribes. And that's where we get the word cannibal, allegedly. Because Columbus passed along the word Carib and said that they may have been, you know, they may have eaten human flesh. So I believe Carib became cannibal. That's one of the proposed, you know, etymologies for cannibal. Another word for the Caribbean, give or take a couple islands, is the Antilles, the Antillean Islands. The Antilles were named after Antilia. Antilla is like the Spanish version of Atlantis or Avalon. So it's all, you know, let's just kind of look across the map for a sec. In Ireland, they had the other world, right? These different names for it.
Well, we've talked about the Tuatha De Danann on the show and how these creatures came from somewhere in the West, right? This is this group of people, the Fomorians were like the beasts, and then there was this other class of people that were more like the Fae, right? And they all came to Ireland from this other world, right?
Yeah. And, you know, the Phoenicians, the Vikings, you know, Ireland was a pit stop for them. Iceland was a pit stop. You could basically take the northern route, which takes you past Ireland, some of the islands north of the British Isles, like the Hebrides, Iceland, over to Canada, and then down the Atlantic coast. Yeah. Or you can go down towards the Canaries and try and shoot the gap to almost the coast of South America. And then come up the coast, come up the Atlantic coast, up the Caribbean, up past Florida. That's what Columbus would do. He'd go down to the Canaries and then take off from there.
As you sort of were describing, he took a lot of time to gather what information was available, because maybe it wasn't written down. Obviously, this kind of information wasn't written down, but it was probably passed around by sailors and people who knew, you know, navigation, you know, going back to, you know, this Roman period where, you know, we've had several guests on the show establish pretty good evidence that Rome knew about the Americas and maybe was the sort of the reason for that missing copper up in the Great Lakes region. I think it's in Michigan. They have a copper mine with tons of copper that's been taken out of there, and there's really no explanation in the official way of explaining these things as to how, where the copper went, because Native Americans weren't using copper like that. So what, you know, what was the source? Where was, who was behind that? There's a ton of mysteries there. Sorry to cut you off. I'm just kind of trailing off here.
No, that's all right. No, you're exactly right. Yeah. The Romans, and I think that that adds to kind of the picture I'm painting here, is each culture over on the old world side, quote unquote, old world side, had their version of a legend, a myth, some type of memory of Florida. I meant to say America. All right. I'm too Florida centric. But the Americas is what I meant to say. Some of them, I believe, did have a unique memory of Florida.
Well, and so here's the thing.
We'll get to those.
Yeah, and you were kind of getting to that. Maybe I'm jumping ahead of you, but when you mentioned how these different groups of people would navigate across the Atlantic Ocean, you mentioned that Columbus sort of tried to skirt that gap, because obviously South America, to anyone who's familiar with geography, South America's eastern coast juts out pretty far into the Atlantic Ocean, but we also must reconcile the Gulf Stream. I imagine if they were able to make it across the Atlantic going westward, then going eastward back home would be really easy, because we know that this warm water streams out from the Gulf of America, or Gulf of Mexico as it's formerly known, and up the East Coast, across the Atlantic in the north, and into Europe. Yeah. So they would have had an easy way home if they did make it out this way.
Exactly. And that, you know, the Gulf Stream is referenced in so many variations of the Atlantis myth, the Atlantis story. The Bach Saga talks about the Gulf Stream. You know, the Gulf Stream is a crucial component to the Bach Saga and many other you know, spin-offs of the Atlantis legend. But also how so many things end up following the Gulf Stream, so many different voyagers. That's why the Celtic legends are so important too, because even if you start off in Africa, for, you know, no matter who you are, Greek, Phoenician, whatever, let's say you do get lucky, cross the Atlantic, you take the northern route back. Maybe you find out what the Gulf Stream is and take it back across the Atlantic. Well, you're probably going to be farther north than you'd like to be, unless you're from that area. And so then they'd have to come down much of the time. So many things wash up in Ireland. Many things wash up over there that have taken this big, long journey. And that would be true for, you know, people who were blown off course, or, you know, had no idea where they were going. But the Celts had their legend of the other world, which at times was just like spiritual, almost like an underworld or a dream world, maybe. But in many legends, it was very much geographically described. Like, all right, across the Atlantic Ocean, the land in the west, and just right down to the name, Avalon means land of apples, and that's what Appalach means too, the Welsh version of Avalon, and or one of the Welsh versions of Avalon, loosely synonymous with Avalon. Appalach means land of apples. That's what Avalon means too, is land of apples. So,
if which, you know, for anybody who knows your channel well, knows that there's you know, fruits play a pretty big role in this research because, you know, humans eat food. We're going to share food across the world. It's a great commodity, right? So, but let's get into that etymology of apple, because when we hear apple today, we think of the modern apple, but that's not what the word has always meant. I learned that from you recently. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so apple in Northern Europe, that word's been around a pretty, really, really long time. In German, you know, Apfel, and over in Welsh, you know, Avalon or Celtic or something over there. Avalon, Apfel, right? It's all pretty much the same root. It's been there for a long time. Now, back then, when you go back a couple thousand years, you know, maybe more, 5,000 years, whatever, they didn't have the apple, not to my knowledge. The common apple, the conventional apple that we call it today, apple, that is from Kazakhstan, I believe. But before, that word, apple, was applied to almost any fruit that was larger than a berry. So maybe not a melon, like a large melon, but something in between, right? So a big, big citrus, piece of citrus, if it found its way into Northern Europe, might be called an apple. And if you want to kind of step outside the bounds of conventional etymology or, you know, linguistics, get more, you know, mystical with it, there's an undeniable association between apple and Apollo, right? The golden disc, the golden ball, the sun. Sun god, the golden apples of, you know, Greco-Roman mythology. So when I look at apple, I see Apollo, right? That's more of like the golden apple. I see Apollo. I also see a connection with Aphrodite with a P, right? So not to be lewd here, but, you know, a red apple is very much like associated not just with the Bible story, but like, you know, the female body in general, temptation, you know, sexuality, apple bottom jeans, you know, something like that. I like to point out citrus is very much masculine, right? It's like a perfect sphere, right? But an apple is undeniably kind of more feminine in its curves, right? In its qualities. And also, when you look at apples, astrologically, they're ruled by Venus. And Venus is Aphrodite in a way. And so the astrological rulership of citrus is solar. But apple, it's more Venusian. That's important too, you know. But yeah, apple's an interesting word. And just to bring it to kind of a, you know, segue to another real interesting topic is the whole Garden of Eden story in Florida centers around a river and an area called Apalachicola, which was named for the Indians who lived there called the Apalachee Indians. They lived there close to Pensacola, Tallahassee, over there on the Gulf Coast of Florida. And it's said that Prince Madoc specifically went to the Gulf Coast of America, it's believed, and that there was many Welsh traits and Welsh words in the Indians, you know, in the Mississippi, all the different tributaries of the Mississippi and stuff. And the Mandan tribe was one tribe specifically that was mentioned. And people say, oh, that's been debunked, but I don't think so. But the Apalache name is so fascinating because just, you know, in Florida, we have he didn't win, but he ran for governor of Florida, E.E. Calloway, the guy who wrote the book about the Garden of Eden being in Florida, called In the Beginning. E.E. Calloway said the Garden of Eden was in the Apalachicola area of Florida, right where the Alabama and Georgia state lines come very close together, where Florida, Georgia, and Alabama all come together, right over there. And then the Apalachicola River flows down into the Gulf. And he said, the Apalachicola, this area, which is actually one of the most biodiverse areas in the world, it's an ice age refuge, which means things survived there that didn't survive anywhere else. And it's one of the most, you know, temperate in a good sense, one of the most hospitable climates in the world. It's kind of Florida at its best. You know, people say, oh, Florida's too hot or too tropical or whatever. Well, Apalachicola has more of a southern feel to it. It also has elevation. It's one of the few places in Florida you'll see rolling hills and little cliffs and stuff. And that place is called Appalachia. And that's down at the very southern end of the Appalachian, what turns into the Appalachian Mountains. I'm not going to call them mountains, but the Apalachicola River is basically the, and the Apalachian Indians is the origin of the name Appalachia. So from there, that's where the Europeans started off exploring the rest of Appalachia, the mountains, the Smoky Mountains, Blue Ridge Mountains, all that stuff, you know. So Appalachia, not many people know this. There was an effort around the time of Abraham Lincoln to rename America. And they were coming up with different names. And they wanted to have a name that was unique from South America. They either wanted to consolidate like North America into a different name, or give the United States of America more of a nice single name, right? Instead of being like the United Arab Emirates, you know, it's kind of a mouthful. They're just going to give us a nice name, you know, country name. So the two finalists for the renaming of America was Allegheny and Appalachia. So we almost are living in Appalachia today, right?
How was that vetoed? They decided to not officially change the name?
Yeah, it didn't get finalized. I don't remember the specifics. I don't know if it was ever something that went to Congress, right, or if it was just kind of a petition. But it was a real debate. It was pretty fierce at times. There was thousands and thousands of supporters on either side. And so we almost live in Appalachia, which is pretty cool. And to your point about how many, you know, how some of the theories about the Bible in America are, you know, maybe out of vogue today, they're kind of, or maybe even scoffed at, right? Well, before, you know, we mentioned Columbus. There's also people like Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Jefferson, who was really an interesting guy, he, if I'm not mistaken, he instructed Lewis and Clark, hey, when you guys cross America, I want you to write down all the Hebrew traits and characteristics. Tell me everything Hebrew or biblical that you guys see when you're crossing America. Now, I don't think they had anything for him when they came back, but he did, in fact, request them to do that because he was a believer, or he was at least very interested in the Jewish American Indian theory. And then you can even look at some of Abraham Lincoln's writings are surprisingly proto-Mormon in a way. Like, he almost kind of compares Adam to Jesus, you know, how like they mirror each other. And then he also mirrors Moses and Columbus. And I don't think he knew that that Columbus saw himself like that too. And the Mormons actually look at Columbus almost as like a saint or a, I don't want to use the word prophet, but almost like a extra biblical figure who, belongs alongside all these other kind of holy men throughout history. They really revere Columbus and see him through a religious lens, which Columbus did himself. So there's all these other names, you know, all these other great people. And
who, well, I don't know if there's truth to it. It is kind of something that's been maybe seized by ancient aliens and taken in a different direction. But you surely know the story of Columbus seeing the lights off the side of the boat at night and being guided to shore. And there's this whole idea that he, you know, was guided by aliens, or in this maybe more rational way of looking at it, maybe it was a prophetic sort of symbol, a sort of religious experience happening where, you know, he believed in something so much connected with it, you know.
So I think what that's going off of is Columbus claimed to have seen a light.
Yeah.
The night before they landed. Now there's a couple of cool little spin-off stories there, but I don't think that was, you know, I've read through his journals. I can't recall them by memory, you know, but I've read through most of his journals, especially on his first voyage and his, you know, first four voyages. What exists, I've read through most of it. I don't remember any kind of UFO thing, but I believe what they're at least a little bit referencing is in October, like right before he landed. I think the night before he landed, he saw a candle or something like a candle. He saw a light that was almost dipping up and down close to the horizon. And they kind of, I think, used that and just kind of steered towards that for a little bit. But there's a debate. So pretty interesting. There's been all these people who kind of go through the crew members, Columbus's crew members, and they, you know, they list which ones were Jewish or crypto Jews or not. And the reason I heard about the guy who first sighted land was because he was allegedly a converso. I forget his name. I think it was, here, I'm just going to look it up real quick.
And let's take a break to thank our sponsors. First and foremost, all the awesome people who sign up on Patreon to support the show and get every episode of this podcast ad-free and interruption-free. That's right. If you're sick of the ads, if you're sick of the interruptions, sign up on Patreon, patreon.com/MFTIC, or myfamilythinksimcrazy.substack.com, where you get every episode of the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast completely ad-free and interruption-free. All right, let's thank our sponsors. First and foremost, the number one sponsor, the only sponsor, True Gold. True Gold, True Gems. That's right, they're real gems. That's Vibe Med X offering you True Gold in the form of a supplement that is great for your health no matter what you may be up against. That's right, She Legit is an adaptogen. Adaptogens conform to what your immune system needs in that moment. So She Legit could be the perfect fit for you. Go to VibeMedX.com and use the promo code CRAZY to save at checkout. That's VibeMedX.com, promo code CRAZY. Hey, folks, it's me, the host of the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. That's right, Mystic Mark, telling you about meat brought to you by Omaha Steaks. You've heard of them before, Omaha Steaks. Well, listen up. Omaha Steaks is raising the stakes and upping the quality because not every steak is good enough to be an Omaha Steak. They're looking for consistency. Hand-selected master butchers, okay? And they know what they're doing. They've been doing it for over 100 years. Their 110th anniversary is coming up next year. Yeah, that's right. Five generations of meat people. These people know me. And they've got the grass fed. They've got the triple trim. They've got the Wagyu, okay? Chateaubriand, filet mignon, all right? Listen, if you're eating meat, they're cutting it and they're sending it to you straight to your door. And with the promo code BEEF, you're going to save now with Omaha Steaks. You've heard of them before. They've been around, folks. But little did you know that Omaha Steaks is raising the stakes right here with the My Family Thinks I'm Crazy podcast. Use the promo code BEEF right now and man up or lady up and get some beef or chicken, air chilled chicken, delivered straight to your door. Okay? No funny business, no nonsense. Don't ever buy meat off the back of a truck in a parking lot ever again. No, no, no. The real connoisseurs of meat go to Omaha Steak. Use the promo code BEEF at checkout. That's omahasteaks.com. Use the promo code BEEF at checkout. omahasteaks.com. Promo code BEEF.
Rodrigo de Triana, his name was on the tip of my tongue. He's the guy who first sighted land, and he's believed to have been a Jew, a converso or a crypto Jew. And interestingly, he's believed to be the guy who first sighted land. And some people say that Columbus came up with the candlelight story in order to claim that he saw land first, because there was a reward for claiming that first sighted land. And if I'm not mistaken, Columbus received that reward because he claimed he saw the light. So
he claimed that there was a fire candle off in the distance on the shore, and that so first dibs, basically.
Okay.
Yeah. And you know, the only real mystery was that when they did get to shore later on, I don't think they saw many fires. I could be wrong. So they were kind of like, oh, what was that light? But, yeah.
Oh, I just, trying to jog my memory, looked up something relating to this. But Columbus, you know, going back to, you know, him doing research and trying to figure out what information was available about this new world, came across, according to this Wikipedia article, the account of a 5th century BC Carthaginian named Himilco knew about the Sargasso Sea. And if you look at a map of the Sargasso Sea, I mean, it's pretty obvious to anybody with eyes that the currents kind of just take you right from the coast of Africa across down to the coast of South America and into the Caribbean. I mean, yeah, it's pretty straightforward. So this idea that, you know, people hadn't been there before is kind of silly. But there was a lot of competition for resources at that time. And I've even heard that, I think it was the Genoesean sort of government, whatever they were, royal family or such, they had like a plot of land in Italy that was their kingdom. They had all sorts of evidence of the new world, and they had hidden it away somewhere in Scotland, right? This is the whole mystery of this certain, I'm blanking on the name of the place in Scotland, but there's allegedly new world plants depicted inside of this Scottish chapel or something. Yeah,
Rosslyn Chapel. We've got a couple books on it. It's like a, I forget if it's like a Templar thing or It's like a proto-Freemasonic thing. I forget when it was constructed, but certainly before Columbus.
Right, and well, I guess what I'm getting to is, like, this is all within the realm of very highly classified information in the hands of very powerful and noble people, and yeah, probably some maybe esoteric groups in between, you know, the few people who were knowledgeable enough to read and whatnot probably collected this information and held on to it. So it was like a sort of, I don't know, a battle to, in many ways, a sort of espionage about who would get there first. So this whole idea that Columbus would lie about seeing it first doesn't surprise me. It's sort of just par for the course. But then also, yeah, you know, getting into this whole, you know, Judaic or Jewish angle with everything, like, there's certainly a esoteric undercurrent to Judaism, right? There's like a whole aspect of it that is inherently occult. Maybe some of this information was, you know, sort of known when people like Columbus, whether he was Jewish or not, I think it's pretty obvious he was, but when they were being exiled from Europe, I mean, it's like right out of their religion. You know, here they are again being exiled, and where do they go? Maybe this secret Holy Land, America.
Have you ever heard of the legend of the Red Jews?
I feel like I even saw something on History Channel where they interviewed a Native American person who had claimed to be Jewish, and everyone in his tribe had like biblical names, but like Old Testament biblical names, and so on and so forth. So if that's what you're alluding to, which sounds like Red Jew would be like a Native American Jew. Yeah.
A little bit, you know, that's what I think the explanation is. But Red Jews, it's a old Jewish legend from right before Columbus's time. So the 13th to the 15th century, right? Right up into the 1400s, right before Columbus leaves. You know, there was kind of some writing on the wall. They had been kicked out of some places. The writing was on the wall in Spain. So 1391, there was all these massacres in Spain. Jews were being, you know, killed. There was mob attacks on Jewish businesses and stuff, and mass conversions, forced conversions in some cases to Christianity. So they kind of had 100 years to kind of prepare and, you know, devise a plan up until 1492. So 1391 to 1492. But even before that, a couple hundred years before that, so 1200s to the 1400s, there was a legend called the Red Jews. And this is before they'd ever found the Americas, anyone. And it was basically a legend that it was about a kingdom in a faraway land that was full of maybe not necessarily Jewish people, but Israelites, lost Israelites, Hebrews, something out there. And the association with the color red is pretty interesting. So they were called the Red Jews. There's, you know, different explanations why, but some people said it did have to do with appearance, you know, that they looked red. And remember, I'm always talking about red hair and Jewish people, and that's one of the evidences that Columbus was Jewish, is he had red hair. Not many Italian men have red hair. Very, very few, actually. Jewish men, however, have some of the most red hair, second to Celtic people. So there is the red hair side of it, but also complexion, right? So a reddish complexion certainly brings to mind the Native Americans. And this was something the founding fathers would always talk about, was, well, were the Native Americans lost tribes of Israel, or were they in some way influenced or in some small part descended from the Israelites or just Phoenicians or some other Semitic people who happened to get, you know, stuck or stopped in America. There's all these theories, right? There's the Phoenicians that could explain it. You know, some Phoenicians were Hebrew. Some Phoenicians spoke Hebrew and had the Hebrew religion, and vice versa. Some Israelites, you know, had the Canaanite religion or the Philistine religion, and, you know, they were hiding it or infiltrating. And so there's all these different kind of cross-pollinations or different explanations of how they got here. The Mormons have their explanation, which I don't fully agree with, but certainly some kernels of truth to it. But yeah.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I know there's more to it than, you know, just the complexion. There's, you know, certain similarities in religious beliefs and even just geographical, like toponyms and things like that, where, you know, certain rivers match descriptions of places that we don't really have a place for in the traditional, you know, accepted convention of where biblical events took place, right? Because there's a whole science to, you know, the biblical history, right? These people who go and study only that, and they try their hardest to find maybe archaeological sites to back up this stuff. So this kind of throws a big wrench in all of that, and maybe a reason why a lot of this has been, for the most part, in our recent time since the science of archaeology began, pretty suppressed and rather unknown to most people. But it does coincide, like this kind of stuff was talked about a lot, and then archaeology comes around and all this stuff is kind of forgotten about, and these new theories about the Native Americans being only from the land bridge, Clovis first. I mean, even to this day, you look at what's going on with like Flint Dibble and all this nonsense, like people just argue about the Native Americans and this sort of provenance of where they came from, when, you know, it seems like more and more evidence shows that it had nothing to do with coming from Asia. It's a lot more complicated than that, right?
Yeah. You know, I think there is one kind of, you know, I would say if there's one thing that we can kind of all rally around, is that the bulk of North American Indians, the bulk of their kind of genetic contribution, came from Asia. And I'd say probably from the Bering Strait. Now, I agree with you that all the other alternatives are totally downplayed, if not outright discounted. But I'd say, you know, with all the theories that I'm into, like the Irish and the Welsh coming here, and who else? The Vikings, the Phoenicians, Greeks, Romans. With all that stuff, Turks, you know, Muslims, even. With all that stuff
too, there's the ancient legend of that king who set like sail across the Atlantic with like what would be equivalent today is like billions of dollars, and just like went and no one ever saw him again. And then some came back and was like, "Yeah, we made it. Bye, guys."
Yeah. So, you know, even though I'm interested in all these theories, you know, I never want to give the impression that I think all the Native Americans, you know, had to come from somewhere else. Like, I do think we can work around and use kind of the baseline that most Native Americans seem like, yeah, they did wander over from the Bering Strait. That's kind of like the base template of Native Americans, of the majority of their genes, their ancestry. But I'd say all the regional variations are almost, in my opinion, they're easily explained, apparently, you know, evidently explainable by different cultures, you know, so, or different, voyages, one-off voyages.
Well, and here's
attempts at colonization. You know, like up in the Northeast, they have Viking DNA. They have more Viking DNA, and even into some of the Great Plains. You know, I think the Vikings went up into these places, and you see some of these Indians who are like 6 foot six, 6'8". You know, up in your territory, right? You're up in that ballpark, I think.
Oh yeah, my own height. Yeah, but also this region that I live in. Yeah, like the Great Lakes, and you know, upstate New York, and even to this day, like a lot of those guys who grow up on the res up there are big dudes. Mm-hmm. Like lacrosse players. You look at the guys across, they're all big guys for the most part.
Yeah, and you know, in the Northeast, if you just even go ask the Mi'kmaq tribe, they themselves, in their own legends, they have legends of, they have a history of, yep, the Templars came here. Yep, the Vikings came here. We remember that too. Yep, the Welsh, or, you know, different Celts came here. We remember that. We remember the Basque whalers coming by. We remember Portuguese whalers coming by. They say we remember so much of this stuff. So the Mi'kmaq, who may have even had a type of written language the whole time, you know, their clothing was very sophisticated. Their technology was very sophisticated. Their lifestyle was almost on par with, like, you know, very, very Northern Europeans, like almost like, close to the Sami, or, you know, something like that. The Sami, Sami people up there, like in Northern Scandinavia, you know, living off like, whales and deer and, you know, a lot of leather, a lot of wrapping stuff up, and, but also beautiful clothing that was like, you know, you didn't see that in the middle of America. You know, some of the Great Plains Indians, or some of them, were truly like naked most of the time, you know, wearing very little, just wearing kind of leather skins and stuff. But up in the Northeast there, they had a pretty sophisticated, you know, way of life. And even some of the longhouse culture, you know, the way they'd live in their homes seemed to be reminiscent of Viking or Celtic culture. And then you go down to like the South America, and yeah, it seems pretty evident. Even now, they're kind of admitting, the genetics show that many of the Southwest, so down in South America, along the West Coast, the Pacific Coast, they've got a ton of Islander DNA. They've got a ton of, you know, almost like Indonesian, Malaysian, all, you know, all that stuff, Islander, Oceanic DNA. So, you know, these don't have to be the best sailors in the world either. You know, sometimes you just, I want to say get lucky, but sometimes you can get unlucky and get thrown across, taken by a storm, and
Part of it is like people discount like getting strayed on a current. Yeah, just like we looked, or I looked at this map here of the Sargasso Sea. I encourage people to go and look that up. You see the currents taking people around the Atlantic. The same thing's going on in the Pacific. There's a guy, Thor Heyerdahl, who made the voyage across the Pacific with just a raft. He called it the Kon-Tiki voyage. It was pretty famous when it happened, but he was like one of these guys who studied exactly what we were talking about and wasn't necessarily promoted for it. So he went out and did this kind of stunt to get more attention on it. But yeah, I think people discount how much of a melting pot the world already was. Like, we get this idea that, oh, America's this great first time experiment where for the first time, all these different cultures melted together into one. It's like, I don't know. I think that's been happening for a while, and maybe it was already like that. And we get this homogenized version of history. You know,
I think some like Chinese people were coming over, Chinese-ish, East Asian people were crossing and reaching places like California, the Pacific coast of North America, Mexico. There's always been this kind of strange affinity between parts of Mexico and parts of China, you know, like this Chino culture, you know, it's almost like a reference to Chinese people. There was a large Chinese presence in the, you know, the western parts of America, like around the Civil War and stuff, and the whole gold rush and all that. There was thousands and thousands of Chinese people here, you know. And I've always wondered and kind of explored maybe some explanations. You know, did they have some ancient connection to this place? Was it on their radar for longer than we think? There are theories about like big piles of stones, and there's like stone walls across the western United States. Some people think might have been like Chinese or Asian. There's some cool artifacts that have even washed up in off the coast of Florida that look Chinese. Now, some people say those could be from just the old Spanish kind of gold and silver trade, because sometimes they would go from the Philippines all the way across the Pacific to America, load a ship in the Caribbean, and then take it to Spain that way, the long way, you know, or maybe not so long. But and that could explain why some Asian things would kind of be shipwrecked off the coast of Florida. But there's all these cool little theories. And then also certain like rainforest, like Amazon tribes, there's like a pretty wild genetic or almost like apparent racial variation in some of the uncontacted or like little rarely contacted tribes. Some of them look pretty like Latin American, maybe with just very squinty eyes. Some of them look almost more African looking, you know? And
there's a significant amount of research that shows humans change genetically when they live inside of a rainforest. I mean, that's how we get these pygmy type people that are found all over the equator. And it's, I think, multiracial. I don't think there's only one race of pygmies. I think it can happen to any type of person. It's like just the shrinking effect. Like the same thing happened to the Javan rhinoceros and the Indian elephant. Like being in these smaller conditions shrinks a creature over time. You know, you're claustrophobic, so to speak.
So you're absolutely right. There is kind of a weird thing about being stuck on an island and getting smaller. But Mark, did you also know that there's a thing called island giganticism?
Well, I was referring to more what happens inside within a rainforest.
Right. Okay. Yeah. You're right.
Giganticism on an island. Tell me about that, because that sounds interesting.
You're right. Sorry, I might have inserted the island.
Okay.
Into that. But yeah, you're absolutely right. But there is something called island gigantism. So, certain animals, when they're maybe dropped off or stuck on an island, they actually get bigger. Now that depends, you know, kind of on food availability and stuff and predators, but it can happen. So, in some of like the giant theories and stuff, there were legends of giants out in the Caribbean, stuff like that, but. Yeah, I didn't want to take us too far off course, but
no, I mean, we can get back to the island conversation because it is more within the region of what we wanted to talk about. But you're speaking about people specifically getting bigger, not just animals. But yeah,
well, it's usually like rats that it happens to. Like hedgehogs and rats, I think, like the Wikipedia, you know, mainly talks about.
Interesting.
But yeah, rodents and stuff. Well, I guess it can happen. It can happen to primates too.
Luckily, in the case of the Komodo dragon, it was the opposite, because if we had an island of humongous Komodo dragons, that would inevitably be a problem somehow. So there'd be some kind of drug lord who made it an invasive species somewhere like the hippo. But when we, you know, started the conversation, the intention was to get into Jewish pirates, and I've definitely taken us way off course, no pun intended.
That's all right.
So you brought islands up. Let's talk about that, because Columbus notoriously was Spanish, but as you know, the esoteric side of things points to him being maybe actually Jewish. And that was kind of a thing back then. A lot of the conquistadors were what we call crypto Jews, because at that point in history, the Catholic Church was not a fan of any Jew. So if you lived in Spain, you either had to, you know, not be Jewish or leave, right? So this was kind of where we get that. And then maybe in within Mexican culture, you know, you see today Mexico, I think the president of Mexico is Jewish, and people sometimes point that out, like, why is that? But hey, maybe this is just more evidence to show that there's this sort of undercurrent of Judaism within Spain and the whole Spanish, what was the Spanish Empire.
Yeah. So there are some wild excerpts from books like Jewish Pirates of the Caribbean that kind of demonstrate just how, you know, pervasive and prominent the Jews were in Latin America, especially in Portuguese, you know, America. So in that book, Jewish Pirates of the Caribbean by Ed Kritzler and a couple others, and in the words of almost a dozen different historians and academic scholars, they basically say all say the same thing. And you can test this if you just like keyword search it. Between 1450-ish, maybe 1500 and 1700, between there, so the 1500s, 1600s, early 1700s, to be called Portuguese in the Americas was synonymous with being Jewish. It was a kind of a don't ask, don't tell kind of nickname for Jews in the New World, because Jews were outright outlawed in the New World. So to even whisper or to gossip about someone being Jewish would actually, yes, you could get, you know, yes, you could kind of accuse anyone of being Jewish, but it's kind of like going to court. You know, if you drag someone to court, you have to go to court too. So everyone was afraid of the Inquisition. People were afraid of making false allegations, and people were afraid of getting dragged in and being squeezed for, you know, more accusations, because that would happen too, you know. And so basically, no one would even, people would rarely even utter the word Jew in the New World. And if they did want to do that or just kind of speak casually about someone who may or may not be Jewish, they would call them Portugals or Portuguese. And that was a well-known, almost like a don't ask, don't tell situation. Beyond that, though, like you said, even the conquistadors, so people who were Portuguese or wearing the mask of Portugal, did not face much scrutiny. So Jews could pretend to be Portuguese in the Americas, or they could make a pit stop from Spain, then Portugal, then to the Americas and call themselves Portuguese. And that would free them up from scrutiny, because under Spain's, under, you know, I forget which king basically proclaimed all well, here's the origin of it. In 1492, the Jews get kicked out of Spain. They had about five more years in Portugal to stay and get ready and, you know, regroup. So many of the Spanish Jews became Portuguese right off the bat. That's the origin of that conflation between Portuguese and Jewish. But then after that, they all had to leave or convert. But eventually, the king, one of the kings, made a declaration that conversos of Portuguese descent, or any Jews of Portuguese descent, would be given almost like a free pass, you know, look the other way, because they needed Portuguese support. They didn't want to be... There was other times where Spain and Portugal were at each other's throats fighting, and any Jews who had claimed to be Portuguese and side with the Spanish would kind of get amnesty, right? So there's all these different kind of weird tie-ins that led to that association between Portuguese and Jewish. But going back to the even just the name, to be a Portuguese, we've all heard of, this is a real thing, we've all heard of court Jews. You know, it's a real, almost like a title or an occupation. There's a whole Wikipedia page on court Jews. King Ferdinand had court Jews. Queen Isabella had court Jews. Most of Columbus's friends were high, you know, very, very influential court Jews. Well, there's also a thing called port Jews. Okay. And that's basically, it can be, you know, both, they can be derogatory a little bit, but it's basically pointing to this, you know, this reality that Jews have often congregated near port cities. Jews have historically functioned as the go-between or buffer between multiple cultures. They historically specialized in speaking multiple languages for, you know, mercantile reasons, you know, being able to speak with more customers, and being at the port, speaking as many languages as you can, gave you an advantage to trading and so on, gathering information. So, and even to, for example, today, if I'm not mistaken, most of Florida's harbor pilots, who are basically the people who take, they take a smaller ship onto the larger, like, freight ships and cargo ships that come in, and, or even cruise ships maybe, and they are harbor masters or harbor pilots who know the layout of Miami Harbor, the Tampa Harbor, whatever. And they'll actually get onto the ships and lead them in because they're so familiar with it. They kind of take over the vessel on its last part of the voyage into the harbor. That has almost always been a, like, Jews dominate that industry. They have historically been very overrepresented in port affairs, right? You hear words like port authority, right? Port, you know, people talk about maritime law and all this stuff. You know, it all does kind of tie in. But the port is basically the economic front door of a country or a city or a, you know, a state. And, you know, Jews, be it, because, you know, I'm not saying it's just like a stereotype, but maybe it's their, you know, whatever you want to call it. It's just a tendency of the Jewish people to often congregate and form their communities around rich, busy ports. And so when you look at the word Portugal, right, I look at it two ways. You can have fun with this word two ways. The Bach saga and some others, some of the more Phoenician and Celtic theories would say it's the port to Gaul. And I think that's more of a mainstream explanation. Portugal is the port to Gaul, because that's kind of one of the last stops before you make it around the bend from the Mediterranean out past the Pillars of Hercules, or, you know, the Straits of Gibraltar over there. And so Portugal's one of your first or last stops going up over towards Gaul, the Gaulish lands, which back before, like, Roman times was France, a little bit of Spain, maybe Germany, Ireland, etc., Gaulish Celtic lands. So the port to Gaul. Right. But you could also look at it as Portugal. You know, these are the Portuguese people, right? They are port people.
Right, because you can't just walk there. There's the Alps, historically a huge barrier separating the north and south of Europe. And traveling by sea is the way to go, especially if you're trying to make money. So it very interesting. I've never heard this connection before, but it makes a ton of sense, especially considering, you know, at the forefront of exploration in the new world were all these companies that were based in ports for the most part. Like that was their whole, you know, the British East India Company, the Dutch East Indies Company, West Indies Company, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Like these were port affairs.
Yep. And the Portuguese, you know, well, sorry, the Jewish Pirates of the Caribbean book, it focuses heavily on Portuguese history. You know, it starts off with the Spanish Inquisition, Columbus, you know, almost doing this daring rescue mission, escape mission to find a escape route for the Jews to some other land that they could just be totally free from the tyranny and persecution, you know, in Europe. You know, don't want to be too mean, but, you know, they were certainly getting chased out of a lot of places. They had to go somewhere. So many went to Islamic lands. Many crossed into Morocco, who would later on would also end up in the Caribbean and the southern United States. But the Jewish Pirates of the Caribbean starts off kind of with the Inquisition, with Columbus, the Jewish financiers. It talks about the Portuguese a lot. It also talks about how Jamaica was kind of bequeathed to the Columbus family. So Columbus had a lot of territory disputes and inheritance disputes. He found all this stuff, but they didn't want to give it to his family. The Spanish crown didn't want to give it to his family, maybe because he was secretly Jewish. The family was secretly Jewish. But eventually they did give it to, they gave Jamaica to the Columbus family. And Jamaica, under Columbus family rule, became a Jewish haven, became the Jewish capital of the New World. And, you know, have you ever heard people say, like, Jamaican money, you know, Jamaican some money, you know, Jamaica, whatever. Some bad jokes there, but, you know, Jamaican money. So they were making money down in Jamaica, the Columbus family, and that's another big part of the book. And then it talks about the Dutch and how the Dutch and the many of the Dutch, you know, East India Company, West Indies Company, many of those Dutch people were actually Portuguese Jews, Spanish Jews, who were later allowed to settle in what I believe was Protestant Amsterdam, because there was an affinity there between some of the Protestants and some of the Jews, and they would unite against the Catholic Church, because the Catholic Church kind of shot themselves in the foot, in both feet, by going after the Protestants and the Jews at the same time, because they kind of formed an unlikely alliance. That's kind of where we get Amsterdam and New Amsterdam. New York was the product of that, you know, cross-pollination.
Well, absolutely. You see it in New England, you know, studying the history of New England, you look at Harvard and Yale, and there's, you know, Old Testament symbols right there in their college seals. Like it's right in your face, you know. And a lot of the mottos and emblems come from Old Testament ideas, and, you know, not that there's anything inherently wrong with some of them, but it just seems like it's a coded message to some degree, you know? Yeah, man.
And, you know, even just kind of on that level, there's a cool book that we carry here, or not so much the book, more the author, a guy named Oz Guinness. He's not to patronize or like whatever, but he's kind of a normie, you know. He's not like a huge conspiracy theorist or whatever. He's not in our ballpark necessarily, but he is very wise, intelligent guy. I don't align with him on everything, of course, but he, in his books here, I'm looking at his one book looking at me right now called A Freedom Like No Other. I think that's a new one. That's like a wake-up call to America. But let me look up the titles of his other books. Oz Guinness. He, and I believe he is related to the Guinness family that, you know, that we're thinking, that everyone thinks of. But he writes about America, and something he emphasizes is the Old Testament and the Hebrew Israelite influence on the founding of America. So not necessarily Jewish, but the Old Testament Hebrew and Israelite influence on America's legal system, on our government, on the, you know, and how America was founded on the concept of a covenant. So you can call us kind of a republic in a sense, you know, democratic republic or whatever, constitutional, you know, democracy, whatever they're calling it. But you can also look at it as a covenantal government, right? It's an agreement between man and God, and in a sense, you know, the whole thing about God-given rights and being endowed with liberty and stuff. So, you know, there's some interesting stuff there. You know, we don't have to look at it all through just like a, you know, Jewish conspiracy theories. There is kind of this nice, beautiful, ancient association. And there's good and bad in there. And hey, everyone wanted to get to America. You know, can you blame them? Like, America has all the fruit, all the nice food. Most of the world was eating mush until they found America, you know? Like,
and considering what's going on with Israel today, it's like the Jews already kind of found their homeland. If we accepted all this as you know, history, as opposed to what it kind of sits in the sort of realm of the alternative now, maybe they wouldn't feel so inclined to genocide Palestine and genocide every country around them, the Gaza Strip and so on and so forth, all these little ghettos that they've created around Israel. You know, it's a shame that that's going on. I can see where the animosity would build and people would get this sort of anti-Jewish sentiment and try to see a Jewish conspiracy in everything. I can see that. But at the same time, yeah, I'm with you. There's definitely a silver lining and a reason to follow the golden rule still. You know, we're living in a world where we all have the freedom to choose whatever religion we want. It's funny though, Juan and I, we were talking about something on a recent episode where some basically voodoo practitioners were taken to court, and their argument was, well, you know, I think it was a case that had to do with mistreatment of animals. And they argued that, well, if people within the Jewish temple can sacrifice animals, and how is what we're doing any different?
Yeah.
And under those, you know, sort of that argument, they were let off of the charges, whatever the charges were. And yeah, it was taken as freedom of religion. So, yeah. I mean, yeah, there's definitely downsides and upsides. It's a complicated mix of things, but it's really fascinating when you add the element that this stuff has all, for the most part, remained, I think, disregarded history, you know. And that's kind of what I like to talk about the most on this show, is the things that have been kind of disregarded or suppressed, you know. So very fascinating. I'm glad you have covered this, and you've covered it to a very lengthy extent. You have three separate videos on the topic of Jewish Pirates of the Caribbean. So I think anyone whose curiosity was piqued is naturally going to go and check all three of those videos out like I did. And very fascinating stuff to be found all over your channel. But as far as what you're doing next, do you have any plans to cover a future book, a book you haven't covered yet, anything on this sort of template for what's next?
So, yeah. So there's three out so far. or three parts out so far, but there's going to be 11 parts total on that Jewish Pirates series.
Ongoing. This is by no means concluded. We're just getting started.
Yep. Wow. And so so people can listen to all those, but then also there's another book that's very similar. So I don't know how close together I'm going to do them, but there's another book called Sails of Hope, which was by Simon Wiesenthal, the infamous, celebrated Nazi hunter. So he's the guy, multiple movies have been made about him. Basically, he is one of the guys, Israeli or Jewish, you know, very much Jewish guys, who went hunting Nazis after World War II. And he found, I think, more than anyone else. And so I forget if he was like officially Mossad or just affiliated with them, but he was, yeah, one of his Israel's like top spies, James Bond type figure. And when he was kind of slowing down his career, almost retiring, he wrote this book called Sails of Hope, which was, you know, if Jewish Pirates of the Caribbean spends maybe one or two chapters on the Columbus story, Sails of Hope is entirely about the Columbus story, much more in depth, going in, naming his financiers, the Jewish members of his crew, things like that. And basically that book it's a little smaller than Jewish Pirates of the Caribbean. It's very rare. It's hard to get. It sells for about $200. And not that many copies were made. And that book's not well known at all. Not very well known at all. So I have a copy of that. It took a little while to get. But it was a very good book. I'm probably going to do an audiobook of that. I can't say audiobook tech, you know, illegally. I don't know. Trim that out, or maybe not. I don't care. But you know, I'm just kind of reading them chapter by chapter and posting it. So I don't think the publishers like that. Well, with Sails of Hope, I don't think they're going to care. But with Jewish Pirates, I got to kind of be a little careful. So
unofficially, it's just journalism.
Yeah, exactly. It's all fair use. So, but then, you know, I'm also in the works. I'm working on a book. We're working on republishing In the Beginning by E.E. Calloway, L.V. Edison Calloway. That's his book about Florida being the Garden of Eden, and about Noah's Ark being constructed out of gopher wood, which only grows in Florida. And so a lot of those theories go back to him. But again, you know, Columbus had very similar theories hundreds of years beforehand, and I don't think Calloway even knew about that. So,
right. Yeah, see, I love to hear that something that was probably very inaccessible is now going to be made more accessible, because that's a big issue with these books. You know, when they become super rare, maybe they become more expensive or valuable because of that, but they also lose what their intended value is, which is for that knowledge to be shared and discussed, whether it's correct or not, you know. And that's kind of the interesting loop of this conversation, is because we sort of started talking about that and now we're finishing by talking about that. But I would love to see you do that with more, you know, rare books or books that are maybe only available in cheap scans online, like taking them in and giving them a new life. And think of a few authors who deserve that treatment. Because unfortunately, yeah, there were people who wrote about this stuff way before it could ever be appreciated. And it's just sort of been neglected in time. So kudos to you and your brother for doing that. I hope your brother's doing well as well. He's been on the show before. Shout out to the Professor Longo. But anyways, thanks again, dude. Really appreciate you joining us. Obviously, Old World Florida is where you can find Dr. Narco every week. But Gallo Glass Books is the publishing venture that you were just describing, right? This next book by Calloway is going to be published through that. So people can go and check out Gallo Glass Books and it has its own website, right? So,
Yeah, my brother's already put out 3 books, kind of personal projects, and I'm working on the Garden of Eden one. We're going to be doing a lot more than that. And the audiobook, if people want to listen, the audiobook for In the Beginning is, I can call that an audiobook. That's okay. No one has the rights to that. In the Beginning, there's a full audiobook on my YouTube channel that people can listen to if they want to hear it. It's one of the most fascinating books in American history. So I really do have the privilege of getting to like serve this on a silver platter to everyone. He is like Florida's Manly P. Hall. He's like Florida's Rudolf Steiner. He's like Florida's, I don't know who else. I mean, the guy is so unique, mysterious, open-minded. He had almost some like theosophical leanings in his location and time that was very unique. He ended up bumping into this unique, basically he's kind of drawing from the same vein, in loosely speaking, that people like Jordan Maxwell came out of. So Jordan Maxwell's also from Florida, and they had some similar influences, believe it or not. So Jordan Maxwell was kind of a little later, a later generation, but everyone knows about this guy. Really interesting guy. We're having an interesting Florida governor race right now. People should go vote for Fishback, James Fishback, if they're in Florida. But governor race right now. And what I'm putting out is it's going to be the original book served in a modern, nice, you know, presentation, nice package. And I'm going to add, at least 100 pages or so of updated information, things Calloway didn't know about, all of which support his theories. And I feel like I have the right to, you know, kind of add some stuff. You know, I think he'd be okay with it. So I'm not adding to his work. We're just kind of putting in footnotes and clarifying stuff at the end. But
very cool.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, I'd be happy to talk to you about that when it's ready to be published and all that good stuff. So yeah, feel free to reach out and we'll get you in touch with Sam and the guys, because I'm sure they'd love to have you back on and talk about that kind of stuff as well. But until next episode, thank you all for tuning in. Be on the lookout for more stuff from Old World Florida. And until next episode, immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now. And that is our episode with Dr. Narco Longo. You can find him on Old World Florida. That's a YouTube channel where he posts every week. Does some lengthy live streams. He does shows with our friend Juan. So go and check it out today at YouTube, Old World Florida on YouTube. He also did an interview recently with Kurt Metzger that was interesting. Antagonistic, to say the least, it seemed. I don't know if Dr. Narco Longo has a bone to pick with Kurt, but Kurt's a big dog, you know? Kurt's one of the big dogs, so it didn't, he wasn't pestered much by it, but it is odd that multiple times Dr. Longo tried to call Kurt schizophrenic. But anyways, to each his own, that's podcasting. So shout out to Old World Florida and all they do. Shane Longo over there too, he's the best. And we'll catch you on the next episode. Until then, immerse yourself in the moment wherever you are in the now.